Good evening. You're tuned into Talkin' Music on KVNF 90.9 in Paonia and KVMT 89.1 in Montrose and on the web at kvnf.org. This is Allie Lightfoot, and today we have a special program in honor of the legendary musician Lou Reed, who passed away last Sunday. Lou Reed profoundly influenced generations of musicians as the leader of the Velvet Underground and then remained a vital solo performer for decades after. Indie rock essentially begins in the 1960s with Reed and the Velvets. Then he was part of the punk movement, new wave movement, alternative rock movements of the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. In April of this year, Reed received a liver transplant after experiencing chronic liver failure. The procedure was done at the Mayo Clinic in Cleveland, but the doctor that performed Reed's surgery earlier in the year said that his end-stage liver disease could no longer be treated. He said, "We all agreed that we did everything we could." And he passed away at his home in Southampton, New York, with his wife, musician and performance artist Lori Anderson. I'm here with Brian Cambria, and we'll be taking you through Lou Reed's life and music. So what was your experience with Lou Reed? Why are you here today wanting to participate in this little tribute to him?
Well, I thought it was pretty sad to hear that he passed away. I grew up on Long Island, as did he, and we grew up in Freeport, Long Island, which was a rival team for our high school lacrosse team and all that stuff. And while he was about 10 years ahead of me, he had a similar growing up experience as I did, other than the generational difference, but suburbia and then a lot of the post-war boom and expansion, all part of our both of our lives. And as he became a musician in the 60s, you know, he got out of college and started playing right away. He really took off, never, you might say, because his music was so strange to a lot of people. But he was definitely ahead of a lot of different things. And when I came of age, we used to spend a lot of time going into the city to see music shows, mostly rock and roll shows. And a couple of my favorite haunts were Carnegie Hall and the New York Academy of Music. And I got to see Lou Reed play in that concert in December of 1973 when they recorded the music for Rock and Roll Animal and one of the Lou Reed live albums. And it was pretty striking. It really made a big impression on me to see this guy doing his thing on stage. My memory, of course, is 40 years old now, but it seemed like it was the angry Lou Reed in those days. He was definitely an innovator in a lot of ways, you know.
His first recording was with a doo-wop style group called The Shades. And then in 1956, Reed, who was bisexual, received electroconvulsive therapy as a teenager, which was intended to cure his bisexuality. And he wrote about that experience in the song Kill Your Sons. He said that they put the thing on your throat so you don't swallow your tongue. They put the electrodes on your head. That was what was recommended in the Rockland State Hospital to discourage homosexual feelings. The effect is that you lose your memory and become a vegetable. You can't read a book because you get to page 17 and have to go right back to page one again. His parents.
That happens to me still.
Yeah. And his parents were the ones who forced him to go through that. That might have been what gave him his drive to be free, basically, and not be tied down to any conventional viewpoints, gave him the motivation to just go out there and explore the world and not be literally tied down by anything.
Or perhaps it was the trigger for his rebellious nature.
Certainly. And he went to college in Syracuse. Some of his early influences were poets for the most part, like Delmore Schwartz, who was at Syracuse when Lou Reed was there. And that's what gave him his start with writing. And also what made him include so much poetry in his work, I think.
Right, he would recite poetry on stage.
Mm-hmm. And then he was a staff writer for Pickwick Record Label, which was sort of a record label that just tried to put out hits really quickly. So he started writing one-hit wonder songs. And that's where he met John Cale, who was his main creative partner in his life. Cale was a founding member of the Velvet Underground and longtime collaborator and sparring partner of Reed. And after Reed's death, Cale posted this message. "The news I feared the most pales in comparison to the lump in my throat and the hollow in my stomach. Two kids have a chance meeting, and 47 years later, we fight and love the same way. Losing either one is incomprehensible. No replacement value, no digital or virtual fill. Broken now, for all time. Unlike so many with similar stories, we have the best of our fury laid out on vinyl for the world to catch a glimpse. The laughs we shared just a few weeks ago will forever remind me of all that was good between us." So when Reed met Cale, they immediately hit it off and they started playing some of the songs that Lou was writing on a street corner in Harlem on 125th Street. And some of these early songs included "Waiting for My Man" and "Heroin," which were later released on the Velvet Underground and Nico album. The songs that Lou was writing back then were more of a portraiture and not autobiographical. And right. I thought that was interesting because he writes about some of these things so very clearly that you would assume he had experienced it all himself.
Well, he was a good observer for sure. And any kind of a writer is really going to be doing that, painting a picture of the world around them in a lot of ways. And certainly he did. A lot of songwriters do that.
Yeah, and when I hear my favorite album of theirs is the very first one, the Velvet Underground and Nico album. And I started listening to that in the 90s when I moved to New York City. And I just felt like that music completely captured New York City to me.
Yeah.
And especially sort of the underground art scenes and music scenes that were still happening in the Lower East Side and Alphabet City and different parts of New York. His music just captures that perfectly to this day. So we're going to hear a song that they used to play on the street corner back then. This is "I'm Waiting for My Man" by the Velvet Underground.
$6 in my hand, up to Lexington, 125, feel sick and dirty, more dead than alive. I'm waiting for my man. Hey white boy, what you doing up? Boy, you chasing all women around. Oh, pardon me, sir, it's furthest from my mind. I'm just looking forward to different of mine. I'm waiting for my man. He comes, he's all dressed in black. Shoes and a big straw hat.
That was I'm Waiting for My Man from the Velvet Underground, and this is Talkin' Music. We're doing a special in honor of Lou Reed. I'm Allie Lightfoot, and I'm here with Brian Cambria. And so as we continue to explore the life of Lou Reed, we'll have to delve into the Velvet Underground days here. In the mid-60s, the band was playing coffee houses and dumps, as they describe it. Pop artist Andy Warhol comes into one of these dumps and immediately falls in love with what they're doing and invites them to be a part of his strange little world that was going on at the time, hanging out at the factory. The Velvet Underground and Nico is an album that the band members never thought they'd be allowed to record. Andy Warhol made the decision to record the album and then try to sell it to a record label, rather than the more conventional route of securing a contract first. The result reflects both the sense of freedom and the economic limitations. It was recorded in a cheap studio with only 4 microphones available. Prior to the sessions, the Velvets rehearsed constantly, working on new arrangements and determined to transfer much of their unique sound to vinyl as possible. There's been a lot of speculation over the years about Warhol's role in the making of this historic album. He did the artwork on the album, which is one of the most famous covers of all times. It's like
the big banana.
And the banana on the cover is typical of Warhol's work. You could peel it off, and a pink banana would show up on inside, which is interesting.
These days it would be a rainbow banana.
Yeah, exactly. The album also credits him as a producer, but he wasn't really, there was no producer. What Warhol did qualified more as sort of executive input.
executive input.
And this is how Lou Reed describes his involvement. Andy was the producer, and Andy was, in fact, sitting behind the board gazing with fascination at all the blinking lights. He just made it possible for us to be ourselves and go right ahead with it because he was Andy Warhol. In a sense, he really produced it because he was this umbrella that absorbed all the attacks when we weren't large enough to be attacked. As a consequence of him being the producer, we'd just walk in and set up and did what we always did, and no one would stop it because Andy was the producer. Of course, he didn't know anything about a record production. He just sat there and said, "Ooh, that's fantastic." And the engineer would say, "Oh, yeah, right. It is fantastic, isn't it?" And how Nico got involved was, and how would you describe Nico to somebody who doesn't know?
Well, I don't have a personal experience with her. But I'm interested to hear what you have, because my understanding was that she was kind of forced on the band. And the reason why it was called the Velvet Underground and Nico was because they wanted to have a very clear demarcation that she was not with them.
Exactly. Yeah. And she wanted to have that demarcation.
Oh, did she also? Okay.
As well. Yeah. And she was one of the, you know, people that was just hanging around the whole Warhol scene at that mm-hmm. point. She was beautiful, and they, you know, there's a lot of photographs of her. That was part of the thing that Warhol did, is that he really wanted to combine music, film, photography, dance, art. He was really one of the first true multimedia artists.
Mm-hmm.
And so what he did was he created this thing called the Exploding Plastic Inevitable. All the original songs that were on The Velvet Underground and Nico were performed as part of this multimedia extravaganza. The Velvets accompanied a 70-minute silent black and white film. And the idea quickly evolved into something more ambitious, utilizing dancers, lights, strobes. And this is what Andy Warhol said about the Exploding Plastic Inevitable. "We all knew something revolutionary was happening. We just felt it. Things couldn't look this strange and new without some barrier being broken." And a lot of the group's themes, I think, that were present in the very beginning, like love, sexual deviance, alienation, addiction, spiritual you know, exploration, I guess you could say, stayed in Reed's work throughout the long run of his solo recordings, too. Let's just hear one more song from the Velvet Underground. This is one of my favorites. It's called Pale Blue Eyes. And then we'll go into the 70s, which is where Reed takes off on his solo career.
Sometimes I feel so happy. Sometimes I feel so sad. Sometimes I feel so happy. But mostly you just make me mad. Baby, you just make me mad. Linger on your pale blue eyes. Linger on your pale blue eyes. Thought of you as my mountaintop. Thought of you as my peak. Thought of you as everything I've had but couldn't keep. I've had but couldn't keep. Linger on your pale blue eyes. Linger on your pale blue eyes. If I could make the world as pure and strange as what I see, I'd put you in the mirror I put in front of me. I put in front of me. Linger on. Linger on your pale blue eyes. Your pale blue eyes.
we did yesterday, and I'd do it once again. The fact that you are married only proves you're my best friend. But it's truly, truly a sin.
Blue Eyes from the Velvet Underground. You're listening to Talking Music on KVNF. This is Brian Cambria, and Allie Lightfoot and I are kind of talking, maybe a little reminiscent about Lou Reed and his life, reviewing some of the high marks or the low marks, however you want to look at it, in his career. And Pale Blue Eyes, that was an example of some of his excellent wordsmithing, though. His writing, he studied, as you mentioned, in college under some pretty interesting poets and writers, and came away with the belief that it's important to say the most you can with the least the number of words.
I like how dark his material is, but also really sort of sentimental and romantic, especially
right,
when he's singing about, love and love relationships.
He's a true New Yorker in that way.
Yeah. In fact, there was something I read about when they were in the Velvet Underground and they went on tour, and they went to California to play in San Francisco, and apparently they were not well received in California because they were too cynical and
too
dark.
Cynical.
They had to go back to New York where they were accepted.
There was almost nothing he wouldn't try. It seemed as though if you could define him in some way, it was that he was willing to try just about anything and experiment in just about any way that occurred to him. Whether it had any, whether it was music and writing, or whether it was sex or drugs and anything, in his music as well, though he tried so many different things, and in many ways, much like you were talking about Andy Warhol when you were talking about him being the producer, looking at all the flashing lights, ooh shiny. He was an enabler, though. His presence and his spirit enabled these guys to do what they did, and Lou Reed kind of took up that same place in his own way. He tried different types of rock. I've heard punk rock was birthed by him, that he certainly opened the door for that to happen. He enabled others to go there. Glam rock, I've heard it referred to.
When he was hanging out with David Bowie.
Out with David Bowie, which is when Transformer came out, Lou Reed wasn't really making it on his own, although he started out on his own after he split with Velvet Underground in 1970, I think it was. And David Bowie, who Lou Reed had helped, turned around and turned the favor back on him and helped him to produce that other album, Transformer, which is a wonderful album for sure. A lot of great music. We could play all kinds of it. And then he went on to start, so many different types of music. And he also flirted with fame, if you will. Just like anybody, he wanted to be famous and recognized for his music and his writing. And then as quick as it was coming on, it's like he turned his back on it, and the high point of that, at least in my view, was when he did those concerts at the Academy of Music in 1973. And I was just lucky enough to be there. But that concert at the Academy of Music was quite a show, to say the least. And I saw many shows over the years in the 70s there. There's talk, about him doing heroin on stage. Well, I saw that. We were all mouths agape looking at that, watching him. When Lou came out for that second set by himself, he plops a chair down and he sticks a spike in his arm. And people say it wasn't real. Well, we all thought it was real at the time, that's for sure. And it sure looked real to me, but that's the extent of my experience with heroin. So after a few minutes of him being high and kind of adjusting, he pulls it right back together and he starts playing. And in my memory, it was heroin that he played. Now, he did play it during that set, that's for sure. It was really something.
And we'll listen to that song in just a moment. I read something where this is sort of during his, when he was entering his punk phase.
Right.
So during this phase of his, he said that he created this character on stage as a performer, but it wasn't remotely like him. And then after he created it, he thought it might be fun to be it. Mm-hmm. So he just went ahead and did that.
I can see that. Yeah. And think about it. You know, my wife's an actress, and there's definitely a distinction between the actor and the part, and then sometimes there's not a distinction between the actor and the part. You always put a little bit of yourself into every part that you play. And that's when he apparently got into more constant heroin usage. And I read somewhere that someone's opinion, it was a way for him, people like David Bowie as well, to cut the edge of the compromises that they had to make between their creative self and their successful self. And when you listen to the song Heroin, it doesn't sound like anything's evening out at all to me. It sounds, in that song, like I would imagine heroin coursing through your veins. It sounds like the kind of rushes that you would be feeling if you were experiencing that same thing.
Well, let's hear it, the song Heroin from Lou Reed.
Ship going from this land here to that. sailor's suit and cap. Away from the big city, where a man cannot be free of all of the evils of this town and of himself and what's around. Oh, and I guess that I just don't know. Oh, and I guess that I just don't know. Of me, heroine. It's my wife and it's my life. Because a man to my vein needs to a sinner in my head, and then I'm better.
And that was Heroin from Lou Reed. And I'm here with Brian Cambria. This is Allie Lightfoot. And we're
talking music.
We are talking music. We're talking about Lou Reed, who passed away last Sunday. Right now we're in the 70s, where he put out quite a few albums. He put out White Light, White Heat. He put out Berlin, which was...
dark.
Which was very dark. Lester Bangs, a reviewer, called it the most depressing record he'd ever heard.
It was a story album. It was about two people who live together, and the themes they cover are domestic violence, drug abuse, suicide. We're probably not going to play anything from that one.
Well, it's pretty amazing. I mean, the most depressing record you've ever heard. That's quite a feat, actually, to accomplish that.
Everybody's got to be good at something.
Yeah, right?
That song, Heroin, think about it this, though. At the time that Lou Reed wrote that song and released it, the Beatles were coming on the scene with All You Need Is Love.
Yeah, totally different.
They were
different places happening there.
Yeah, he experimented. He didn't just experiment. He drilled into it. He drilled down.
And a lot of people were inspired by his fearlessness and his sort of rebelliousness. Blondie, Patti Smith, Talking Heads, Suzanne Vega, all of them say they were influenced by Lou Reed. he put out this thing called Metal Machine Music, mm-hmm. which is four sides of electric guitar feedback strobing between two amplifiers.
Right, a double album.
Yeah.
Those were big in the 70s.
And, you know, there's rumors about it, like maybe he put it out just to get back at his record company who was like forcing him to put out an album. I'm going to play an interview with Lou Reed about this album in a moment, and you'll hear what he has to say about it. But he wrote in the liner notes that no one I know has listened to this album all the way through, including myself.
Well, and that might exemplify it. You know, people who have addictive personalities often have a pretty assertive nature about themselves when you try to contain them, let's put it that way. And, you know, the way my brother described it was drinking wasn't a problem for him. It was an attitude. And happily, he's over it. You know, he's past that. And happily for Lou Reed in his life, he got over heroin and drug addiction and moved on and found a different place in life that he was more comfortable with that enabled him to continue to create some interesting stuff for sure. But that attitude is probably nowhere more exemplified than in the production of that album.
Metal Machine Music.
Right.
So here we're going to play an interview for you with Lou Reed talking about the creation of Metal Machine Music and some other sort of sound recordings that he did, some experimental stuff. Stay with us.
Back in 1975, Lou Reed released a double LP called Metal Machine Music. It was an album of raging feedback, with no drums, no rhythm, and no melodies, except those engendered by the clashing overtones. At the time, many wrote it off as a joke, or an album to break a recording contract.
I've heard all the rumors about that, and none of it's true. I mean, I'm in love with it. Was in love with it then, am in love with it now.
Three decades later, the guitarist who founded the Velvet Underground and who has been an icon of the tougher face of rock has released the flip side to Metal Machine Music. It's called Hudson River Wind Meditations, and it's as calm and ambient as Metal Machine Music is loud and dissonant.
The yin and yang of the whole thing is actually kind of funny, but it seems like it's such a natural progression. I was practicing some of these things on a record I made called The Raven. I did a thing called Fire Music, which was my response to 9/11. And I was playing around with a lot of electronics and all these same ideas. They end up being on this record.
There's an entire industry built up around meditation music. We get hundreds of those CDs in every year at Echoes. Pick your new age or alternate spirituality and discipline, and someone's making music aimed at that market. Music for yoga, music for meditation, music for Reiki healing. It's usually soothing, completely harmonic, and produced by people with names like Liquid Mind, Kamal, and Bhakta. Lou Reed's Hudson River Wind Meditations doesn't sound like that. Sitting in his manager's office in New York, Lou Reed is probably in much better shape than anyone of 65 years has a right to be, who's engaged in the drugs and lifestyle he's documented in his songs. That was the Lou Reed of Walk on the Wild Side and Heroin.
'Cause it makes me feel like I'm a man when I put a spike into my vein. And I tell you things aren't quite the same when I'm rushing on my run. Like Jesus' son, and I guess that I just don't know, and I guess that I just don't know.
Lou Reed is more likely to talk about Tai Chi poses than needles in veins these days. He's been practicing the martial art of Tai Chi since the mid-1980s with Master Ren Guangyi. Reed produced a DVD for him with both meditative music and more energized techno grooves.
Our Tai Chi is called Chen Tai Chi, and it's both slow and fast. And I wanted to see if I could make a music that, when you started doing the form to that music, you got energy from it. That was the whole idea. And the guinea pig was me. But I also, you know, did it with my teacher, Ren Guangyi. Nothing done without his approval, believe you me.
But while the motivation for Hudson River Wind Meditations is in Tai Chi, the genesis isn't in meditation music at all. It's in the earliest days of minimalism in the 1960s, when composer Lamont Young was running his Theater of Eternal Music, featuring long compositions based on drones. Velvet Underground violist and bassist John Cale was a member of Young's group, and Lou Reed was exposed to that sound. He even cited Young in the liner notes to Metal Machine music.
I've been listening to certain kinds of music like that for a very long time. You know, it's in my guitar playing also. I mean, I've spent my life playing around with the harmonics from a note. I've always been aware and fascinated by the fact if you generate these two harmonics, when they hit each other, they make a third that wasn't played, and that generates more. But that idea was going side by side with some of these other ideas these other composers were doing, where they're playing around with harmonics in a different format. That leads me right into now, you know, where the kind of guitar solos I'm doing. When I was trying to put this music together, I wanted to have that kind of activity in it.
Although the surface is simple and static, Lou Reed says he's spent years on this work, minutely tuning its sound.
There are a lot of things going on in there that you may not notice the first couple of times around that are really fun. Hector Castillo, the engineer, and Hal Wilner, who worked on this with me. And there was some of these notes that we would combine or shave to make it clearer or make it deeper or not so deep.
Lou Reed says that if you walk into his office or studio, chances are Hudson River Wind Meditations will be playing.
I can use it for a lot of different things, including just be there as the way a tree is there. In my place, I have it going all day, which is better than listening to traffic.
I don't think that's the slogan that the Sounds True label will be using in their publicity for Lou Reed's Hudson River Wind Meditations. Lou Reed's Metal Machine music is still in print, and an acoustic version has just been recorded by the Zeitkratzer Orchestra. I'm Kimberly Haas.
And you're tuned into Talkin' Music on KVNF. I'm Allie Lightfoot. I'm here with Brian Cambria. We're tributing Lou Reed, the late, great Lou Reed, today, hearing some of his music, talking about his life. And now we've made it to the 80s with Lou.
The new Lou.
That's right. This is where he got sober. He got clean and sober. He started going to AA. He kept making music throughout this whole time. We might hear something from New York.
89 was when it was released.
89. And I love off of New York, I really love Dirty Boulevard. Should we hear that one?
I think we should hear Dirty Boulevard. That's a really cool song. If you listen to his words, it's almost like rap. And he's really chronicling what goes on. And in just a few words of describing something that he sees, you hear so much more about what's going on in life and the big picture. Dirty Boulevard.
Pedro lives out of the Wilshire Hotel.
He looks out a window without glass. The walls are made of cardboard. Newspapers on his feet, and his father beats him because he's too tired to beg. He's got 9 brothers and sisters. They're brought up on their knees. It's hard to run when a coat hanger beats you on the thighs. Pedro dreams of being older and killing the old man, but that's a slim chance. He's going to the boulevard. He's gonna end up on the dirty boulevard. He's going out to the dirty boulevard. He's going down to the dirty boulevard. This room costs $2,000 a month. You can believe it, man, it's true. Somewhere a landlord's laughing till he wets his pants. No one dreams of being a doctor or a lawyer or anything. They dream of dealing on the dirty boulevard. Give me your hungry, you're tired, you're poor, I'll piss on them. That's what the statue of bigotry says. You're poor huddled masses, let's club them to death and get it over with and just dump them on the boulevard. Get them out on the dirty boulevard. Going out to the dirty boulevard. They're going down on the dirty boulevard. Going out. Outside it's a bright night. There's an opera at Lincoln Center. Movie stars arrive by limousine. The Klieg lights shoot up over the skyline of Manhattan, but the lights are out on the mean streets. A small kid stands by the Lincoln Tunnel. He's selling plastic roses for a buck. The traffic's backed up to 39th Street. The TV whores are calling the cops out for a suck. And back at the wheelchair, Pedro sits there dreaming. He's found a book on magic in a garbage can. He looks at the pictures and stares up at the cracked ceiling. At the count of 3, he says, I hope I can disappear and fly, fly away from this dirty boulevard. I want to fly, yeah, from the dirty boulevard. I want to fly from the dirty boulevard. I want to fly, 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 fly from the dirty boulevard. I want to fly away. I want to fly. Fly, fly away, yeah. I wanna fly. Fly, fly away.
Fly, fly, fly away.
Fly, fly, fly.
Fly, 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 fly away.
Fly, fly away, yeah.
Dirty Boulevard from Lou Reed.
From New York.
From New York, put out in the 80s. And, you know, then he met Laurie Anderson, I think, in the early 90s. And I saw them once at a art museum seeing this crazy installation. And I thought, you know, those two look perfect for each other. They both, you could tell they both had that whole New York vibe going. They both had like spiky hair.
Black leather.
Black leather. They're both into, you know, experimental art, performance art, trying new things as often as possible. And they were walking arm in arm through the installation and enjoying themselves. And I thought these two people love their relationship. They like being in New York where they can be exposed to this kind of thing all the time. It was a lovely way to see Lou Reed.
Yeah, kind of like a snapshot of something that's totally innocent, totally unscripted.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And apparently they eloped when they were visiting Boulder, Colorado. They just decided to get married, and they went down to the town hall and did it.
Do you mean they didn't get their parents' permission? My gosh, it was a scandal, no doubt. You know, and in later life, he got involved in so many different things. He recently, just in the last couple of years, did a documentary film about his cousin, Red Shirley is what it's called, and his cousin was a survivor of the Holocaust. So while he was in his late 60s, she turned 100 years old, and he interviewed her about her experience and coming to America and being a garment worker as well in you know, back in the early days of her life here. She came here when she was 19. So it's been only an hour, and there's so much more we could talk about.
What a life this guy had, and it's been fun to explore it, and really interesting too. We could talk about his collaboration with Metallica.
That's right.
I mean, and his love of Kanye West.
Uh huh.
He had a huge admiration for Kanye West. Like in the last month of his life, he wrote this rave review for Kanye West's new album, and just thought he was, you know, the new genius on the scene, and it's inspiring.
Right.
To sort of delve into someone who just did whatever they wanted, explored whatever they wanted.
He could hardly care what you thought about him.
I watched the American Masters documentary about Lou Reed. It was called Rock and Roll Heart. And it was, he starts off the whole documentary by saying, "I disliked school. I disliked groups. I disliked authority. I was made for rock and roll." So in honor of that wonderful statement, I think we should hear the song Rock and Roll.
Let's go back to the stage on the Academy of Music on 14th Street in December 1973.
When she was just 5 years old, there was nothing happening at all. Every time she puts on the radio, there was nothing going down at all. Not at all. Then one fine morning, she puts on a New York station. You know, she don't believe what she heard at all. She started shaking to that fine, fine music. You know, her life saved by rock and roll. Despite all the amputations, you know you could just go out and dance to the rock and roll station. It was all right.
It's all right.
Hey, baby, you know it was all right.
It's all right.
Jenny said when she's just about 5 years old, you know my parents are gonna be the death of us all. Thank you.
That was rock and roll music from Lou Reed, one of my favorite New Yorkers, that's for sure. He was a great creative artist and a great observer of life around him, and he really felt strongly about everything that he did.
And we're going to go out with a nice acoustic version of Perfect Day. Thank you so much for listening.
Just a summer's day, drink sangria in the park. Then later when it gets dark, we go home. Just a perfect day, feed animals in the zoo. Oh. Then later, a movie tune, and then home. Oh, it's just a perfect day. I'm glad I spent it with you. It's just a perfect day. You just keep me hanging on. You just keep me hanging. Just a summer's day, problems all left alone. Weekends on our own, it's such fun. Oh, it's just a perfect day. I'm glad that I spent it with you. I thought I was someone else, someone good. Oh, it's just a summer's day. I'm glad I spent it with you. Oh, just a perfect day. You just keep me hanging on. You just keep me hanging on. To reap